They're looking at Parshas Chukas. And of course, the thing that all the Mepharshim talk about right away is the fact that this is called a chok, and chok means a law or a din in the Torah for which we do not understand the reason. That doesn't mean there is no reason. Everything HaKadosh Baruch Hu does has reasons and is true, but some things we understand, and those are called mishpatim, and some things we do not understand, and they are called chukim. And this introduces the chok par excellence, which is the chok of Parah Aduma. Parah Aduma is the red heifer, and the ashes of the red heifer, right, this is a cow, female, it's a cow, that has to be Aduma Tamima. Aduma Tamima means a perfect red cow. That means its redness must be perfect. Rashi explains, based on the Mishnah, that you can have up to one black hair, but no more. Now, people sometimes make a mistake, maybe it's obvious, but for many years I thought, as a younger person, that this looked like a fire engine red. That's not true at all, because to find a fire engine, Paraduma is rare, but it's not so rare. To find a fire engine cow, that would be quite unusual, because cows don't come in that color. Rather, it's the red of Para is the standard brown that cows have, right? Many cows are brown. But very rare is a cow completely brown, right? So paraduma means it's 100% complete. It's called the chok because there are so many aspects we don't understand, and we'll talk about that. But I want to be sure people understand exactly what a paraduma is for. First of all, you may have seen that there is a paraduma now. There is a Christian couple who are devout Bible followers. And they were zocha to have a Parah Aduma, and they were contacted by rabbinical authorities and to be called all the halachos. They can't work with it, they can't use it, because if you work with a Parah Aduma, it becomes disqualified. And they're holding the Parah Aduma until the coming of Mashiach, in which case they will then be able to prepare it and use it to make people tohar. It is at an undisclosed location because they don't want to, curiosity seekers to come or do something that might blemish the para in some ways, but I understand it is in the Lakewood area. So maybe when you go next time you go home, you could check it out, or whatever it is. They did post a picture. It looks like a regular cow, really, because it is a regular cow except for the fact that it's 100%. Now, what do you do with this Parah Aduma? So the Parah Aduma is shechted. Now, it's not a korban, because korbanos are shechted in the Beis HaMikdash. This is shechted outside of the Beis HaMikdash. In fact, when it's going to be shechted, it's going to be shechted on Har HaZeisim, on the Mount of Olives. Its blood is sprinkled, not in the Beis HaMikdash, but in the direction of the Beis HaMikdash. It is reduced to ashes. And then those ashes are kept. And whenever somebody is a tamei meis, in contact with a dead body, so the halacha is that those ashes are mixed with the spring water, gushing spring water, and they are sprinkled on people. And as soon as a single drop of water, in other words, even if it's only the water without the ashes, but as soon as a single part of that mixture hits you, you have to have it twice. On the third day of your tuma and on the seventh day of your tuma, right? So if I go to a cemetery on Sunday, okay, that's not a good example of Shabbos. I go on Monday. So Monday is day one. So Tuesday, Wednesday. So my first sprinkling will be on Wednesday. And, that's not good. What's that Wednesday? Is on Wednesday. That's right. That's day three. And my next sprinkling will be on Sunday. Is that right? Because Thursday is day four, Friday is day five, Shabbos is day six. No, that's not right. Okay, the reason why we're having a problem is, I'm having a problem, is that Midrabanan only, you do not do the sprinkling of Parah Aduma on Shabbos. So even if Shabbos is the seventh day, you're going to have to push it off until the eighth day. But that's okay, because when the Torah says you got to do sprinkling on day three and day seven, that's lav dafka. It just means the first hazaah can be no earlier than day three, but then you have to have 4 days between the first sprinkling and the second sprinkling. So if any day is going to be Shabbos, you delay the first sprinkling, so there'll be 4 days between the sprinklings. Okay, so 3 and 7 are lav dafka. The ikar is no earlier than day 3, but you can do it later. For example, if we would have a parazuma today, and we would be sprinkled, this wouldn't be the third day of our tumah. This might be 10 years from our tumah, since the last time we were in a cemetery. Okay, or if you're a kohen, you might not even remember when you were in a cemetery. But since it's been more than 3 days, you can have your first hazah. You then have to count 4 days and do it on the 4th day, which would have the din of the 7th. So when you're sprinkled on the 3rd day and on the 7th day, then you wait until nightfall, and when nightfall occurs, you are tohor. You are ritually tohor. Now let me point out that you only need Afer Para for one type of tuma, that is the tuma of contact with a dead human body. If you are tame for any other reason, whether it's a seminal emission, whether it's touching a dead animal, which also makes you tame, not if it's shechted, otherwise every time you eat meat you're tame, but an animal that was not shechted, if you touch a piece of non-kosher meat, you're actually going to be tame, because it's a nevela. There's the tuma of nevela. If it's a shechuta, it does not convey tuma. So if I have a seminal emission, if a woman is a nida, if a man touches a dead animal, etc., there is no need for the afer of para aduma. All you do is go to the mikveh. In the case of tumah of a dead animal, you're only tumah 1 day, etc. Some tumahs are longer, but the only tumah that needs the afer of para aduma is the tumah of mace. Now the hazaah is the sprinkling. Has to be done by a kohen, but it does not have to be done in the Beis HaMikdash. So as a result, the Gemara tells us that when the Afer Para was accumulated, they would distribute it regionally. There would be different regions of Eretz Yisrael in which Kohanim would be entrusted with the ashes of the Para Aduma. So if you lived in Tzfat or you lived in the Galil, you would go locally in Tzfat to be able to become Tor. In other words, you didn't have to come to the Beis HaMikdash. Now, why do you have to be Tor? The truth of the matter is, for daily life, you didn't have to be Tor. But if you were a Kohen and you wanted to eat Truma, or even if you wanted to separate Truma without making it Tameh, you have to be in a state of Tahara. So if you had gone to a funeral or whatever it is, you needed to be sprinkled with the ashes of the Para Aduma. So it must be done by a Kohen, but other than the Shechita and the burning of the Para, which is only done once, that's when you make the ashes, which has to be done in the Yerushalayim on the Har HaBayis, the sprinkling of the Para Aduma could be done anywhere. Now they didn't mix it with water until they needed it, meaning Para Aduma was stored as canisters of ashes. And every time they needed it, they would take a little bit of ash, mix it with spring water, and then sprinkle it on the people that needed it. Not just on people, but on utensils. If utensils got tameh mace, we would sprinkle it on the utensils as well, because utensils are also tameh for 7 days when they're in contact with the dead. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, so the gushing spring water, is there a specific spring water? Also,
No. The only requirement is, the phrase the Torah uses is mayim chayim. Mayim chayim literally means live water. So you wonder, well, what's live water and what's dead water? In other words, so mayim chayim is gushing water that moves from an underground spring, as opposed to water that is stagnant or stationary. So you could not use water in a well, for example, but you use water from a spring. So there's no requirement of what spring. It could be a spring in Tzfat, it could be a spring here, and the like. The only requirement of makom is when the Para was shechted and burnt. Now, it is a great miracle, that's Chazal record, that from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu in the desert until the coming of Mashiach, there have only been the need for 10 Para Adumas. In fact, part of the 10th is hidden, in other words, the 10th one, which was made in the time of the Second Temple, the 10th one had not been exhausted when there was the Korban, and it is stored away, And we're going to have that again, because you have to understand there's a certain catch-22 here, because like this, in order to make a parah aduma, by making I mean slaughter it and burn it, the kohanim that slaughter it and burn it, they themselves have to be tahor. But if everybody in the world has the chazakah of being tameh, then how can they become, and you can't become tahor even after 100 years unless you're sprinkled with the parah aduma, then how can anybody ever become tahor? The people who would shech the parah aduma are tameh. How could they do it? I mean, how could we make a parah aduma? The answer is that before Mashiach comes, Eliyahu HaNavi will come back to earth. Eliyahu HaNavi is a Kohen. Eliyahu HaNavi will bring with him the canister that has some of the ashes of the 10th parah aduma. He will be able to mix that ashes with spring water. He will be able to be metayer, let us say, 10 kohanim, 100 kohanim, 1500 kohanim. Once those kohanim are tahor, they can then take any parah aduma that they, the liquid parah aduma, and then they can shecht it and generate more in order to be metayer the rest of Am Yisrael. But you see how important this is. Without one person who's already tahor, you're not going to be, even if we had the canister of the parah aduma, we couldn't do it, because the mazeh also has to be tahor. The sprinkler has to be tahor. So the makers who shecht and burn it have to be tahor, and the sprinkler has to be tahor. So Eliyahu HaNavi is the critical link who will be initially, he will be able to be mazeh on a small number of kohanim, making them eligible to make and shecht a new parah aduma. Now, the miracle is, if you think about how many Jews needed to be sprinkled with the parah aduma, not just once a year, but at least several times a year, because for each of the shalosh regalim, the Jewish people had to come up to Yerushalayim and bring a korban, and korban Pesach, even women and children had to come up. And in the course of the year, if they were tameh, they needed to be sprinkled. In fact, Hazor was a mass process. It wasn't like, oh, I'm tameh, I'll go to the Kohen, he'll be mazami. I mean, you have to imagine it this way. Around the regalim, you had hundreds of thousands of people who needed to become tahor. So Kohanim would simply throw it from the windows. They would basically, like the way you kosher pots, you just immerse these pots in all of this water. So they would throw at people. If you got hit with a drop, like an ofra, if you got hit with something, that was enough. But you had to be hit. If you weren't hit, you were still tameh. You had to be hit twice, right? You had to come back twice for this. So if you think about how much use the ashes of the parah aduma had to go through, how many people needed them, and you're talking about a period from Moshe Rabbeinu until the destruction of the Second Temple, we can figure out exactly how it was. Because it was 480 years from Yetzias Mitzrayim to the first Mikdash. All right, so take out a year or two. But let's see, 480. The first Mikdash was 410. Right, so that's 890 years. And then the Babylonian exile, we didn't use it, okay. And then you have the second Mikdash, which is 420. So you're dealing with more than 1,200 years. The ashes of the Parah Aduma were used more than 1,200 years, and not only that, the truth is, even after the destruction of the temple, this is important. Once you had the ashes of the parah aduma, people were tahor, even after the destruction of the temple, they used the parah aduma. Well into the time of the Amoraim, even. So we're talking about a period, perhaps, of 1,600 or 1,700 years. 1,700 years where potentially millions of people needed to use the parah aduma. And all we used up was 9.5, because there's something of the 10th that is still left over. 9.5 paras aduma in 1,600 years, used by millions of people, is a real, real miracle. That somehow HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave a bracha, just like the Hanukkah oil didn't go down, the ashes didn't get used up until it was necessary to use them up. Yeah.
But
What's the ratio of water to ash?
There is no particular ratio. I mean, the only requirement is that there be enough water that the ashes can float on top of the water. So you have to pour in enough water. You then mix it, but there has to be enough water that the ashes float on top of the water. But the amount it has to hit me as an individual is mamashe mashe, just one drop.
So then when Eliyahu HaNavi comes back, he's probably not... Does the sprinkling have to be a certain method? Like he has to go like this? Or can he take a droplet and just preserve it?
Well, no. The Torah says the way it's done is he doesn't do it with his finger. He takes a hyssop bush, a bush, which is called a piece of a branch of cedar. He dips it into the water, and then he shakes it, and that's what he does. But he can't reuse the water. The water that hits somebody cannot be reused again, so he cannot retrieve it. The water or the ash that has hit someone is now disqualified. Now, let me just mention, you are all familiar with the halacha, that although the Parah Aduma is the vehicle that makes people tahor, the people who handle it become tameh, meaning they have to be tahor when they do the ceremony. But as a result of the ceremony, they become tameh. But people sometimes make a mistake. They think this creates an infinite regression problem because they think, well, what happens is I sprinkle it on you, so I become tameh, so I need somebody to sprinkle it on me. But the guy who sprinkles it on me becomes tameh, so who's going to become, right? You'll never be able to get everybody tahor. That's a big mistake. The reason why that's a big mistake is, it's a big mistake for two reasons. But one reason why it's a mistake is the premise is not true. Although it may be so that the people who handle the Parah Aduma are tameh, their tumah does not require being sprinkled with the Parah Aduma water. Meaning, if I'm tameh because I handle the afer of Parah Aduma, I'm tameh until nightfall, I go to the mikveh, and I'm tahor. Meaning, I don't need to be sprinkled with Parah Aduma. So therefore, my tahara does not depend on passing the buck and making somebody else tameh. Okay, that's one reason. A second reason is, Rashi mentions an important halacha that contradicts the simple meaning of the verse. Although the simple meaning of the verse says, beferish, he who sprinkles the Parah Aduma becomes tameh, Rashi explains the actual person who sprinkles does not become tameh. And rather, when it says he who sprinkles, it means anyone who carried the amount of ashes that was sufficient to sprinkle becomes tameh, but the actual mazeh does not. So the people who become tameh are the kohen who shechs the parah, the kohen who burns the parah, and anyone that carries the ashes. But if all I do is sprinkle without carrying, I do not become tameh. So, but be it as it may, even the guys who become tameh, they don't need hazaah to make them tahor. They're just a tameh of one day, and at nightfall they're going to become tahor. Yeah.
How did we solve the issue of the first kohen needing to be tahor after the Babylonian exile?
The answer is that even in the time, it's a good question, even in the time of Churban and Golas, there were Kohanim who kept themselves tahor. Meaning this idea that all of us are tameh is kind of a later rule. In the time of Chazal, and certainly earlier, there were people who were makbid on tumah. And theoretically that was possible even in the Gola. So as a result, there were Kohanim tahorim who were permitted to do the hazah, yeah.
Were the Amoraim using the Parah Aduma to eat truma? What were they using?
Yeah, to eat truma, basically to eat truma. And the Gemara even says that there were many, many people who were makbid on a volunteer basis, that even their chulin, if you learned Maseches Chagiga, which is a difficult Masechta, you find that there were people who ate their chulin bitahara, that they were makbid on all the laws of tuma, even for eating chulin, although for chulin you can eat, I can eat chulin in the state of tumah, right? There's no problem with that. In fact, the term prushin means Pharisees. So in the Christian Bible, Pharisees are the bad guys. In our version, the Pharisees are Chazal. We call them Chazal. Right? So the Pharisees versus the Sadducees, right? The Prushim versus the Stukim. So typically in Yeshiva, we just say, oh, Prushim just means Chazal, who believe in Torah Shebaal Peh, and the Stukim don't believe in Torah Shebaal Peh. Now that's accurate. But the reason they're called Purushim, Purushim really means separate ones, is that these are people who voluntarily separated from all tuma, eating even their chulin with purity, even when there was no Beis HaMikdash. So, I guess we could say the following. All Purushim were Chazal, but not all Chazal were Purushim. Purushim was a subset of Chazal, who were extra meticulous in the laws of Tumah V'Tara that they didn't have to keep. Okay, so not every, even among our Chachamim, not every Chacham accepted all of those Chumras. The Prushim, in fact, did. Okay, right. So this is a little. So again, I want you to understand this idea of Parah Adum a little bit, because sometimes we don't really get a picture of what was involved. But it is a great, great miracle. So the point I'm making is though, that you can't just jump on the bandwagon. People think, oh, once we have a Parah Adum, we have a Parah Adum in Lakewood, so we could start purifying everybody. Not so simple. You're still going to have to wait for Eliyahu HaNavi, because there is no Jew, who is no Kohen certainly, who is able to make Hazah, because you have to be Tohar in order to make the Hazah, and therefore you need a Kohen Tohar to be able to do that. Yeah?
Could you not protect... we don't know who are actually Kohanim, so because we don't know who is a real Kohen, you can't just sanctify like a group of...
This is actually an issue. You may recall, if you learned Maseches Sukkah, you may recall in the beginning of the second Perek, there was a whole discussion of protecting children from the time they were born, from the time their mothers were pregnant, from any possibility of becoming tame. Pregnant, now, normally that's not possible because even if I walk on the ground, there may be a dead body under the ground, etc. And I'll talk about that. But pregnant women would be brought to cliffs, solid rock cliffs in which there couldn't be a body, you know, in the cliff. And they would be born there and they wouldn't be touched directly by their mothers. Oh, very, very difficult. It's a complicated process, in which children would be segregated from birth to avoid any potential of tumah in order to prepare the Parah Adumah, right? There was such a... So a few years ago, there was a group in Eretz Yisrael that tried to take the... They had women who volunteered, pregnant women, and they would go to a cave wouldn't be good, a cliff, go to mountainous cliffs and the like. And they were doing exactly what you were suggesting, but the police intervened. The police treated it as a child abuse case, and they didn't allow it to happen. But theoretically, that would be possible. But in order for the welfare of children, we say it's better to wait for Eliyahu HaNavi, who's already Tahar, and he's going to handle the situation. Okay, but again, the operative word is that this is called a chok, and the reason it's called a chok is not only because it's generally inexplicable, but in particular, the difficulty is that how can the same thing that makes you pure make you impure? It is the chok of paradox. Paradox is contradiction, and that is what makes it so difficult. But before we continue with Parah Adum, I want to backtrack a little bit and talk about the halakhas of Tumas Meis, because in Parshas Chukas is not only the institution of Parah Adum, but all the laws of Tumas Meis are there as well. So it's important to know these halachas. These halachas are important, number one. In the time of the Mikdash, they were important to every single person. Because if you wanted to go to the Beis HaMikdash, if you wanted to eat, if you were going to eat Truma, if you wanted to eat Korbanos, you had to be Tor, so you had to know the laws of Tumah. Today, it is primarily important for a Kohen who still has the prohibition of contaminating himself, even though he's already Tumah, but he can't make himself Tomei again. That's our psak. So here's the thing: a dead body makes a person tomei for 7 days. Right? It's a unique tuma. Most tumas are only 1 day. Tumas meis is 7 days, but if you don't have purification, you become tomei forever. But if you have purification, 7 days. There are three different ways a dead body can make you tummy. Three different ways. Method number one is I touch the dead body. If I physically touch a dead body, I am tummy for 7 days. Method number two, I carry or I move a dead body, even if I don't touch it. So if I carry a coffin with a mace in it, I am tameh, even though I didn't touch the dead body, I carry the dead body. Right? So one is called the tumah of maga. Maga is touching. The other is called the tumah of massa. Mem, sin, aleph. Mem, sin, aleph. That's carrying. But the third, which is the biggest problem, is ohel. Ohel is, if I am under the same roof as a dead body, even if I did not touch it, and even if I did not move it or carry it, because carrying includes moving it, the halacha is, if I'm under the same ohel, I am tummy for 7 days. Now, there's a whole mesechus in the Mishnayos, which is really considered to be one of the most complicated mesechus in Shas, called ohalos, which are all of the details of ohel, because ohel is a complicated idea. If there's a dead body here, and I'm here, right, so the roof and dead body, that's a direct ohel, right, that's simple enough. Ohel can also include a tree. If I'm under a tree, and there's a dead body under the tree, even if it's buried in the ground, that's called an ohel as well. So ohel can occur in all sorts of accidental ways. You could be driving on the road next to a cemetery, and if there's an overhanging tree that's overhanging graves and overhanging you, that is an ohel, right? And your tummy. That's why there are certain roads in Eretz Yisrael, only here, that are marked not for Kohanim. This road is not for Kohanim because of the idea of ohel. But, right, so that's very simple. The mace is in this room. But let's say you have two rooms in a house. The mace is in the bedroom. And you're in the... Right, someone died in their bedroom. Someone died overnight, and you're in the dining room. Are you tamei? Is that called an ohel? So the normal principle would be that unless there is an open door, or window, or vents, even vents could be connecting the two rooms, if a door is closed, normally they're considered to be two separate ohelim, even if it's technically one roof. But if there's a mechitza, if there's a wall between this room and that room, the tumah does not go from one room to another room. But there's a rabbinic principle that says that if the mace is in a room from which it's going to be carried out, and if it gets carried out, it's going to go through the room that you're in. So a bedroom is a very good example. If there's a dead body in the bedroom and the door is closed, and I'm sitting in the dining room, I am not tameh, because technically, if the door is closed, there's a solid wall, including the door, between me and the tent of the mace, and the tumah does not go from bedroom to dining room. However, if, when the mace will be eventually carried out, it will be carried from the bedroom through the dining room on the way out, so midrabanan, it is treated like it's already in the dining room, and therefore I am tummy. This is a rule that is called sof tuma lutzes. If the tuma is going to go in that direction, you become tummy even if it's not yet there. If, on the other hand, let's say, for example, that the mace is in one bedroom, you're in another bedroom, and the doors are closed, so in such a situation, you are actually tahor. In fact, if you're a Kohen, we would advise you, stay in your bedroom until the mace leaves the house. Okay, because seif tumalatzeis is only going to make you tameh in the room through which the mace is going to be carried. Since the mace is not going to be carried through that second bedroom, you're going to be okay. However, if you open your door, you'll be in trouble, because when there's open space, the tomb of the mace does go into that open door. As long as you keep the door closed, you're going to be okay. Now, this creates enormous problems in hospitals. Number one, a Kohen certainly cannot generally not visit a hospital because there may be dead bodies. But the question is, how can he even go to a hospital if it's not a matter of pikuach nefesh? There may be dead bodies in hospital rooms, and the way it works is hospital rooms are almost always open. The doors are almost always open, so the tumah goes from the room into the hall, into every open room. So in Shaarei Tzedek, religious hospitals in Israel, they've made ways in which there'll always be closed doors where there would be a dead body, etc. And they'll even have an alarm system to tell Kohanim when they can go and when they can't, etc. So they worked it out. In the United States, you're going to have to ask a shayla about hospitals and the like, but it is a complicated issue. Yeah?
Well, any concern about Jewish bodies or also...
Okay, so that's a very good question. So here is the thing. There is a difference between the dead bodies of Jews and the dead bodies of non-Jews. And the way it works is this. Even the dead body of a non-Jew is metameyu for 7 days if you touch it or if you move it. But whether it's metameyu if you're be'ohel under the same roof, that is a machlokas in the Gemara, and it's a machlokas lahalacha how we paskin. Some Rishonim do paskin. There is no problem of tumas ohel by kivrei of the kochavim. Other opinions say it's better to be machmer. So lechatchila, we say you should be machmer. Now, let me go backwards a little bit. I told you there are three ways you become tameh: touching, moving, or ohel. So let me ask you the question. What is the tumah when I walk into a cemetery? When I walk into a cemetery, I become tameh. A kohen cannot walk into a cemetery. I'm allowed to walk in myself, but all of us become tameh, the kohen has an iser. Here's my question. What makes me tameh when I walk into a cemetery? Now, I understand if there's a tree over me and the grave, that would be tumas ohel. But if there's no tree, what makes me tameh? I didn't touch a dead body. I didn't move a dead body. And I'm not an ohel. There's no ohel over me and the dead body. So very simple question. What is the thing that makes you tameh when you walk into a cemetery? The answer is that the Rambam explains that the concept of ohel doesn't only mean there is an ohel over me and the mace. But if I myself lean over the dead body, I become the tent. So what makes me tameh is, now even then, theoretically I'm not tameh because I'm in a cemetery. But I'm tameh if I lean over the grave where the body is buried. If I lean over the grave, I become the tent over the grave. You don't need a separate tent over the grave. I am the ohel. Now that does mean, theoretically, there should be a way that a Kohen should be allowed to enter a cemetery. We would basically tell the Kohen, right, theoretically, do not stand under any tree that or building or roof hanging that is over a grave, and stand in front of a grave, but don't bend over so that any part of your body is over where the mace is buried. Theoretically, if you did that, that would be mutter. But you understand that because it's almost impossible to be totally careful about that, the Chachamim made a gezeira that a Kohen cannot be within 4 amos of a grave. Meaning, even if the grave's here, and I'm only 2 amos away, not allowed to do that. So that's a total derabbanan. So really, to Oraisa, it is not forbidden to a Kohen to enter a cemetery as long as the Kohen is Nishar from Tumas Ohel. Midrabanan, however, he cannot be within 4 amos of a grave. Now, having said that, therefore, we still have the interesting conclusion that theoretically a Kohen can enter cemetery grounds and stay 4 amos away from a grave. I mean, for example, when you have a road, you go to a cemetery, you have a road, right? The road is... the graves are further in. Theoretically, the Kohen could be there, right? The Kohen can go to a funeral, and stay more than four amos away from the grave. Now, he could not attend any eulogy that has the dead body in the building. He couldn't go to the shul or whatever where they have the dead body, because that would mamish be an ohel. But he could attend an outside service, as long, even if he's in the cemetery, as long as he is more than four amos from an actual grave. Yeah.
What's the status of the ohel once the mace has been removed?
Yes, that's very important halacha. It's not a problem. It is not a problem. The ohel itself does not become tameh, and as a result, once the ohel is removed, I'm sorry, once the mace is removed, the kohen may go back into the ohel. Yeah.
If the ohel doesn't become tameh, then what's the problem with the kohen leaning over the grave? If he's becoming the ohel, and the ohel doesn't become tameh.
Well, the problem is, yeah, he is both an ohel and the person.
He's not under himself.
Yeah, well, halachically, we treat it like bon kiyachid. We treat him as both the ohel and the person in the ohel. And as a result, even if the ohel is not tameh, the person became tameh because of the ohel. This is called ma'ahil al hatumah. In other words, he is the ohel over there. By the way, the same is true the opposite way, although it's less common. If the tumas mace, if the mace is above me and there's no break, the mace becomes the ohel, meaning ohel works three ways, therefore. You have an ohel over me and the mace, like roof over me and the mace. I am over the mace, so I become the ohel over the mace. Or the mace is over me, and therefore I'm under the ohel that is created by the mace. All three of them, the Rambam says, are called tumas ohel. And the way it works is, it doesn't make a difference how high you are. That is why, indeed, a kohen cannot fly. We'll talk more about this. It's a very interesting shaila. A kohen cannot fly in an airplane that goes over a Jewish cemetery, because even if the plane is 35,000 feet high, the kohen and the plane are in ohel over the cemetery, and therefore the tumah will make the kohen tameh.
Can tumas mace be transferred from person to person and from kohen to kohen?
Okay, so here's how it works. The halacha is the following. In terms of nomenclature, a dead body itself is called avi avos hatuma, not afatuma. A dead animal is called an afatuma, a primary source. This is the father of father. Now, if I touch a dead body, or I move a dead body, or there's ohel in any of those three ways, I am tameh for 7 days, and I do have the capacity to pass it on to another person for 1 day. For 1 day, meaning if I shake another person's hand, he is tameh for 1 day, he does not need parah adumah. However, the thing to keep in mind is, I do not convey the tumah by ohel, I only convey the tumah by touching, which means the only tumah that gets created by ohel is tumah of the mace itself. So if I went to a cemetery, right? So I'm a tummy, right? So I'm called a tummy mace. I'm not a mace. I'm called a tummy mace. A tummy mace can be metame adam or utensils by touching them, but not by moving them. And he certainly will not be metame be ohel. So if I walk into an ohel, nobody is tummy. And not only that, a kohen has no prohibition of coming in contact with a tummy mace. So if you're a kohen, you can shake hands with somebody who just came back from a funeral. Even though that makes you tummy for 1 day, but the kohen is only muzar, I'm getting direct tumah from a mace. He's not muzar, I'm getting tumah from a tummy mace. Okay? So that you wouldn't have a problem there.
You don't need
need para aduma. You only need para aduma. The correlation is this: you only need para aduma for things that are tummy for 7 days. So the man or the utensils that are in contact with the dead body are tummy for 7 days. The man and the utensils need hazah on day 3 and day 7. but a person who was in contact with a person who became a Tamei Meis is only Tamei for one day. If you're Tamei for one day, it's the same halacha as touching a dead animal, in which you just go to the mikvah and you'll be tor at night. You do not need the ashes of the Parah Aduma, and there is no prohibition of your coming in contact with a Kohen. Yeah.
So then in the Beis HaMikdash, when you had these hundreds of thousands of people jostling against each other, I imagine they would touch each other.
Yeah.
Then it wouldn't be a problem of being re-tomei themselves because of...
Well, there would be a problem because even that remote level of tumah cannot go to the Beis HaMikdash, right? So you have to be very, very careful. And indeed, people were very careful. They had to be very, very careful. Our assumption was that everyone who came to the Mikdash already was sprinkled with Parah Aduma. So they were already in a state of Tohar. Okay? That was the assumption. That's why Parah Aduma was not done in the Mikdash. It was done before you got to the Beis HaMikdash.
In that interceding time, though, say...
In the streets, you mean?
Yeah, in the streets or even in the crowd, if they touched somebody who was Tamei Meis, then it wouldn't affect them for another sprinkling of the...
It would not. The one who is Tamei from a Tamei Meis is only Tamei for one day. Yeah.
Like in the case of the plane, wouldn't the coffin be an ohel for the dead?
Yes. Yeah, so this is a difficult question. Again, maybe we'll talk more about this. I have to stop. I mean, the halacha is a very question because an ohel can make a person Tamei, but an ohel can also block Tuma. So the question basically becomes, if you have a plane that's flying 30,000 feet, the tumah hits the bottom of the plane, why can't that be a blockage? In other words, I'm above, it's like I'm sitting on top. For example, let me give you an example. Let's say I'm sitting on the roof of my house. I'm sitting on the gag. And there's a dead body in the house. According to halacha, although in a literal sense, I am an ohel over the tumah, but the house is an ohel too. And the house blocks the tumah from going past, right? So the person who's sitting on top of the roof does not become Tamei, even if he's directly over the dead body, because the roof not only is Matamei everything under the roof, but it blocks the Tuma from going up, right? Ohel is Matamei everything horizontally, but it prevents a vertical rise. So the question is, why don't you say the same thing by the airplane, right? Let the airplane block the tumah from penetrating the plane, and if it blocks it from penetrating the plane, the kohen is going to be tohar. Yeah, a very, very good question. The short answer is this. The rule is that the only ohel that blocks tumah is an ohel that in itself is not mekabel tumah. Now, a building that is connected to the ground is not mekabel tumah, because mechubar lekarka is not mekabel tumah. A tree is not mekabel tumah. An airplane, however, is made of materials like metal and the like that is mekabel tumah, and the rule is any ohel that is mekabel tumah is not an ohel that can be chotzeitz. Chotzeitz can divide or interpose. So the issue that people discuss about planes, it's not so pushy, is they do discuss that planes are made of different types of materials. Some of them are new synthetic materials, whether it's polyester or even things like, not the outside of the plane, but at least the inside. And some of these synthetic materials are not mekabel tumah. Some of them are, and the question is, so how do you characterize the plane? But you're 100% correct. The Iker Shaila of the plane is it mekabel tumah, is it not mekabel tumah? Because the din of ayel to be chotzeit is only if it is mekabel tumah.
Is the coffin itself mekabel tumah also? The coffin?
Is what?
The coffin, the...
Well, which part of the cabin? The cabin has many materials. Yeah.
Not the cabin, the coffin.
Yeah.
The
coffin generally would be mekabel, yes, normally it would be, because it's wood, or, a coffin is normally wood, metal. The materials of a coffin are also going to be mekabel tumah. The only thing is, but you're raising an interesting question, that when a coffin is shipped in an airplane, it will typically be encased in plastic. And there you get the same shiloh. Maybe the plastic itself is not mekabel tumah. But that's a different issue. See, we're talking about two different shilohs. I'd be sure you understand the difference. There are two different shilohs about kohanim and airplanes. and they're not identical. One is the shaila of the airplane that is flying over the cemetery. The other shaila is the airplane has a coffin in storage. Now that you could find out, but that's another shaila. In other words, can a Kohen fly on an airplane? Because coming from America to Israel, many El Al flights in particular will have dead bodies that are being transported for a funeral. Now there, the shaila is slightly different. When you're flying 35,000 feet, the problem is, will the outside of the plane, the underside of the plane, be an ohel that blocks the tumah from going in? Okay, so that's one set of shaylas. When you have a coffin in the plane, in luggage, so there you're not talking about the outside surface of the plane, you're talking about the floor. Can either the cover of the coffin or the floor, can that be the ohel? See, it's a different question of what you're looking at as the ohel that blocks the tumah. But the issues are the same, meaning are those materials makabel tumah? Now there is a very good argument that plastic is not makabel tumah, and the coffin in the plane generally is encased in plastic. So ironically, there may be more of a heter to fly with a coffin in the plane than flying over the cemetery. But again, you have to ask a rav for all of these shailas. And generally speaking, our minhag is that kohanim do not fly on any flight which has a dead body on board. And allow, you know, usually it's only allow that does it. Not always, but they'll tell you. But they're not going to tell you. They don't know until, obviously, they don't know. They don't know a week in advance. I mean, you make your ticket. I mean, you understand this is a last minute change in plans. You make your ticket from Chutz Lars to Israel. You make it, a month before you go. Elal does not know about a dead body until 3 hours before you go. So you may have to switch your flights or whatever it is. Do they charge you extra for that? I don't know. But you know, the one who does this all the time is Rabbi Kaplan, or David Kaplan. Goes through this all the time because he's a Kohen and he has to be sure that there's no mace on the flight. Yeah.
Have to fly
the
because only they do it.
No, because of the cemetery issue?
No, because of coffin.
I'm saying the opposite. It's only Elal that has the coffins. A regular flight doesn't.
Yeah, so do they have to fly Elal?
Oh, no, not at all. You might say it's better not to fly Elal because if they don't fly Elal, in other words, a non-Elal flight doesn't carry a dead body.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so you're not going to. The only question is that El Al modified its flight routes not to fly over Jewish cemeteries. Other airlines may not, so you have to check. I mean, I can't say I'm totally up to date on this, but there are warnings. Kohanim shouldn't use British Airways on Tuesday because there are people who keep track of this. Because on Tuesday there's going to be a turn over some cemetery in Haifa, and because of this and that. So Kohanim have to be attuned to these things. Yeah.
You mentioned the machlokes about with regard to non-Jews.
Yep.
So with the cemetery there, I mean.
Yeah. So the way, yeah, you're 100% correct. According to that machlokes, there will be a shaila with any cemetery, but I think the idea is here we combine the leniency since some opinions do matter oil for non-Jews, and some opinions will allow the underside of the airplane to be an ohel. So even though we don't rely on either of those things individually to permit, when you have both of them together, right, halacha often says we combine two views, neither of which would be sufficient by itself, but when you have both factors, we're lenient. So the bottom line is we're not machmir over flying over non-Jewish cemeteries. Yeah.
Is it common out to visit close relatives in the hospital in Chutz Lars?
It's a difficult shaila. You have to talk to a rav. It depends where the morgue is. It depends on how often. Meaning like this. You don't automatically have to assume that on the floor that you're in, there's going to be a dead body. People don't die every floor every day. However, if the morgue is connected through vents and doorways and the like, there may be a certain shaila. So you have to get the layout of the hospital. Is the morgue within the hospital building? Is the morgue a separate building? Because the morgue for sure has dead bodies. Are there vents, or, you know, because again, if there's vents, so to speak, that connect, they connect all the different rooms. So you can have something on a totally different floor, but it's kind of connected. There are openings between them. So you need, so really, a rough has to sit down and go over all of the hospital plans. Yeah.
Two questions. What happens if the Kohen's in a plane and somebody dies in transit?
Well, he has to jump out, for sure.
Yeah. And there's just the second question, maybe as a corollary to that, is, you know, the Kohen can't really walk around anywhere in the country, because, I mean, there could be a dead body with solid soil all the way up. I mean, how do they walk around the country?
Well, you know, you're right. I mean, this is actually one of the reasons why we make the statement, everybody is b'cheskas tumah today. But l'maisa, these are drabanans. Min ha-Torah, if I don't know there's a mace, I don't have to assume there's a mace. So l'maisa, Chazal didn't make gezeros that people would be unable to live with. But you're right, theoretically there's a chashash, particularly in Eretz Yisrael. In fact, this is one of the things. So every time they do construction, not every time, but many construction sites, they find bodies. Because, you know, people are buried all over the place, and sometimes the Beis HaKvaros are forgotten in the passage of time. But there are shilas. Sometimes they're identified as in fact, this is Rav Moshe Sternbach, who's a great, great Talmud Chacham, one of the Gedolei HaPoskim. Maybe I shouldn't even tell you this. I mean, basically, he was he was involved with the Eidah Haredes for many years. He was the Av Beis Din of the Eidah Haredes. He left, and he started his own Beis Din. Why did he leave? Because many Kanoim refused to accept his Psak. He had Paskins at a certain excavation that the dead bodies that were found were Goyim, based on the Simanim, and therefore there were no Isurim in relocating them and the like. And there were many Kanoim who literally refused to accept it, and they issued denunciations and posters and condemnations, and there were mavaseim, as some people sometimes do, unfortunately, in very negative terms. So he left the Eidah Haredes Lagamri because of this. So sometimes it's a very lively controversy, meaning you find bodies, but there are many, many dead bodies from the times of the Crusades, Christians and the like. So, and you know, there are simanim, we try to identify. How were they buried? You know, if somebody's buried with a sword, you know, you find a sword next to him, then you assume it's not a Jewish person.
Then the case of the transit, does he have to do something? Does he have to go to the bathroom? I mean,
okay, all right, so that's an interesting question. A Kohen, let's talk about, I mean, normally, okay, let me put it this way. Let's take a simpler case first. A Kohen's in the house and a dead body dies. What does the Kohen do? So it's absolutely very clear that the Kohen must either leave the house or go into a bedroom and close the door. That would work as well. There's even a shaila in halacha, what if the Kohen is sleeping naked and there's a dead body? Do you have to wake him up? And if he wakes up, is he allowed to put on clothes? Or does he have to run out naked? It's a big, big machlokas. Some say, tell him he has to leave the house, but don't tell him why. Because if I tell him why, he has to leave the house naked. But I don't have to tell him because of Kovid Abriya, so he can dress, and then I tell him, you got to go. You know, that's all shaila. So the normal rule is, I don't say, oh, he already became Tomei, so let him stay. He has to leave. So the question becomes, what would that mean in the case of an airplane? Well, to go to the bathroom, you know the way these bathrooms are on planes, you know, if you're going to be there more than 5 minutes, somebody's going to knock, and they're going to break the door down and pull you out. So it's one thing if there's 10 minutes left or whatever it is, although they're not going to let you use the bathroom the last 10 minutes, that's fine. But if, you know, if God forbid this happens and there are, you know, 7 hours more in the flight, you really have no place to go. So in such a situation, you're practically called an onus. An onus meaning it's unavoidable. If a Kohen is stuck with a dead body and has nowhere to go, so the Eibishter, you know, you're not responsible. But yeah, I mean, normally, if this happens in an airplane airport terminal, for example, you would have to go outside. You could not stay in the terminal. You'd have to leave. Well, that's 100% true. Okay, well, we'll stop here.